Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week I fetched a collection of heartwarming, educational, and inspirational tales about man's and woman's best friend. Yes, we're going to the dogs with an entertaining mix of fiction and nonfiction titles. Tales to entertain you, even if you're not a pet person. So let's turn now to page one of the book report. W. Bruce Cameron has written incredibly popular stories about our four-legged friends, including A Dog's Purpose. Love that one. And I'll bet you a box of dog biscuits you'll fall in love with his just-released title, The Dogs of Christmas. While nursing a broken heart, Josh Michaels is outraged when a neighbor abandons his very pregnant dog, Lucy. Josh can't resist Lucy's soulful brown eyes, and though he's never had a dog before, he's determined to do the best he can for Lucy and her soon-to-arrive, bound-to-be-adorable puppies. Quickly in over his head, Josh calls the local animal shelter for help and meets Carrie, a beautiful lady with a fierce love for animals. As Carrie teaches Josh how to care for Lucy's tiny puppies and get them ready for the shelter's Dogs of Christmas adoption program, Josh surprises himself by falling for her, but he's falling even harder for his new furry family. With Christmas and the adoption date looming, Josh finds himself wondering if he can separate from his beloved pups. And if he can't, can he still keep Carrie? Kirby Hayborn narrates.
Ryan turned around and started walking away. The dog watched him uncertainly, coming to her feet but not moving from Josh's side.
Where are you going?
I don't have time,
Ryan snapped, shutting his tailgate with a bang.
I have to go.
Yes, I know. You have to go to France. I'm sorry about your brother, but you're going to have to make some other arrangements. I can't have a pregnant dog.
Well, but first you said you couldn't have a dog at all, and you changed your mind on that.
Josh watched in disbelief as Ryan opened his car door.
Wait, what are you doing?
Josh demanded.
We're not done. You can't just leave. Hey!
When Ryan shut his door, Josh realized that just leaving was exactly what Ryan intended. Josh strode briskly across his yard, prepared to knock on the driver's side window and, if necessary, fling open the door. He could see himself doing it, maybe even grabbing Ryan and pulling the man to the ground. You don't up and drive away in the middle of a conversation, especially when the conversation is, "You can't leave your dog here." The dog followed on Josh's heels, yawning anxiously. Ryan started the vehicle and, astoundingly, engaged his transmission, his four chunky tires spitting dirt back at Josh, who dashed after it.
Stop! You can't do this!
He shouted. Naturally, the SUV pulled away, and Josh, defeated, slowed, and then stopped.
Just great, he muttered,
as the vehicle slid around the switchback and dropped down the hill out of sight. His own keys were on the kitchen table. He could dash in, grab the dog, and take off in hot pursuit. But then what? With that kind of head start, Josh stood little chance of even seeing Ryan on the road, so he'd have to drive all the way out to the airport. Denver International Airport was huge, and Josh had no idea which airline Ryan was taking. And would the authorities really prevent the man from flying to France on the basis of an abandoned dog? Josh warily regarded Lucy, who had stopped following when Josh elected to chase after the vehicle. Maybe she'd tried it a few times before on other cars and had come to conclude there was no profit in it. She was sitting at the top of the driveway, watching him, perhaps waiting for an explanation. Probably sitting was her main activity now. Her belly was hugely swollen with the pups inside her, the teats pronounced, her body heavy. She looked 9 months pregnant, or however many months it took a dog. She watched him alertly as he crunched back up the driveway. So here's what we're going to do, Josh decided. The dog raised her ears a little at this, apparently glad there was a plan. We'll call somebody.
The vet, I mean, okay? There's no way I can take care of you. I don't know the first thing about delivering puppies. Lucy regarded him with her warm, dark eyes. The trust in them was almost unbearable to behold, given that Josh had just told her he was essentially going to dump her off on someone else. That seemed to have been happening to Lucy a lot lately. Where was the ex-girlfriend anyway? What sort of person leaves a pregnant dog with someone like Ryan? Josh sighed and looked around his property. When Josh's father first built the house, the skinny lodgepole pines blanketing the hillside had been beaten back about 24 yards. Josh's mother optimistically planting city grass and flowers. Over time, though, the foreign foliage had gasped and died in the thin, dry air, and now coarse, native ground cover, brown except in June, lay matted at his feet. A stand of aspen trees had steadily advanced out of the woods like 18th-century soldiers, and they always went to color early. Already some of the leaves were full gold, sunlight bouncing off them in flaring explosions of yellow.
That was The Dogs of Christmas by W. Bruce Cameron. Rebecca Asher Walsh is a writer who specializes in celebrity and lifestyle coverage. And she has a soft spot for four-legged stars. In addition to sharing stories of amazing animals and volunteering at a shelter in Manhattan, she is the founding director of Deja Foundation, an organization devoted to raising funds for the care of rescue dogs. Today, we'll speak with Rebecca about her new book, Devoted, 38 Extraordinary Tales of Love, Loyalty, and Life with Dogs. Welcome, Rebecca, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
Devoted is a collection of 38 tales of love, loyalty, and life with dogs. How did you choose the stories to be included?
I chose the stories because I wanted a wonderful range of stories that would appeal to every reader. So I wanted to have some dogs representing the life-saving moments that are very, very dramatic. And then there are other stories that are less dramatic and about a lifetime of loyalty. And, of course, different breeds, since everybody has their own favorites.
Right. You begin the book by writing, quote, "A dog's greatest legacy is the ability to restore our faith in the existence of unconditional love." And then you continue about your own dogs. "I rescued them, but they rescued me in return." I love that.
Oh, thank you so much. I think anybody who has rescued a dog will say something similar, because it's one of those acts where you feel so good for doing something good. And then you turn around and realize that this dog is literally living for you and just wants to be near you. And all of those things that you thought might be overwhelming about the responsibility of having a dog, if you will allow them to sit on your lap or curl up on the floor and you'll take them for a walk a few times a day and feed them dinner, that's it. That's all they need. And they will greet you like you are the best person in the world every time you walk in the door.
That's right. You know, I was so inspired by the Companions for Heroes. Tell us about that.
It is the most inspiring story that continues to inspire me long after I reported it. This extraordinary man who works for Homeland Security now, named David Sharp, came back from the war with very, very bad post-traumatic stress syndrome and adopted a pit bull named Cheyenne. And he was suicidal one day shortly after getting her and sat down on the bed with a fully loaded gun and put it in his mouth. And Cheyenne gently just moved the gun away from his mouth and nestled up in his lap and looked up at him and forced him to make eye contact. And he looked down at that dog and realized that he had to take care of her and that he couldn't go anywhere. And he never looked back. And not only has he not looked back, he has started this extraordinary organization where he pairs vets returning with PTSD with shelter dogs. And the goal is, because the rates of suicide are escalating unforgivably for returning vets, and in addition, we have as many as 9,000 dogs killed daily in this country because of a lack of space, his organization, Companions for Heroes, matches these men and women with a shelter dog. The men and women pick their own shelter dog, but they provide vet care for the first year, and they provide unlimited training on the phone. And when I asked him about why the training on the phone rather than going to the people and showing them, he said, because it gives them more control and power, and they'll call and say, you can't believe it. I just taught my dog how to sit. And then they say, well, what else can you do? And they start taking control of their lives. And they say, well, maybe I can go back to school now. And they become more socialized because they're taking their dogs for walks and people are approaching them and talking to them. So it really is this miraculous story of how one life can be changed by one dog, and then hundreds of lives are changed after that.
Right. And you list some statistics in the book. 18 veterans kill themselves each day in the United States, and every 8 seconds a shelter animal is euthanized.
Right.
Yeah.
And what I love about David Sharp's story so much, and I think it's a lesson we could all learn in the world, or most of us can learn in the world, is that I think we hear numbers like these, whatever they might be about, and we get overwhelmed, and we say, there's nothing I can do, it's too much. Anything I do would be a drop in the bucket. And instead, what somebody like David Sharp teaches us, whether it's about any issue you pick, is we all have something we can do to be of help. And
right.
It can be a very small thing, but we all have time to send our used blankets to a shelter so a dog or two will sleep better that night because it will have bedding. There are things that we can do to make the world a little better in less than 10 seconds.
We're speaking with Rebecca Asher-Walsh on The Book Report. Well, another story in the book really kind of gobsmacked me. Talk about the dog who could sniff cancer.
This is the most amazing thing. I was very moved by all the emotional stories, but this one was so incredible. And the reason this story was so incredible, the dog who can sniff cancer, is this was one of three dogs I spoke to for this book that did exactly this. And here's how this works. And they're actually doing studies in Emory in Atlanta about this, because dogs have extraordinarily acute sense of smell, which is why a shelter environment can be very difficult for them because of all the smells and odors. So they don't have great eyesight, but they have an incredible sense of smell. And these three women, but in particular this one woman in the book, the dog kept poking her in the breast, and she had just returned from a normal mammogram. So she called her doctor. She said, I know you're going to think I'm crazy, but my dog is not, this doesn't make any sense. This isn't what my dog is like. So he said, come in for another mammogram. She went in for another mammogram, and mammogram came back normal. Dog wouldn't stop, and she said, she kept pushing the dog away from her breast, but it kept coming back, and it was always poking at the same spot. So she called the doctor back, and she said, I know I'm going to sound crazy, but I really think I need something else. And she went in for an ultrasound, and they found an incredibly aggressive form of cancer that is not picked up on mammograms that would have killed her very, very shortly. She schedules her surgery, and then the dog starts going under her armpit. So at that point, she doesn't think that much of it because she's scheduled for surgery. It's all going to be fine. When she gets into the OR, before she's anesthetized, she says to the doctor and the nurse, for what it's worth, this extraordinary dog keeps bonking me right here. So they circled it with a red pen. When they did the surgery, they found that that was the single lymph node that the cancer had traveled to. All the other lymph nodes were clear, and they were able to take it out. And it was to the point of where exactly that lymph node was.
All right. You have to tell our listeners about the story of Willow, the dog who can read.
I love Willow. Willow is hilarious. Willow's owner is also a dog walker and dog trainer, and she was bored one day and made a bet with a friend that whoever won this bet would take the other person on vacation. She said, I bet I can teach my dog to read. So she taught Willow to read about 4 signs, and so she can read sit or bark. She can read a sign that has her rolling over, and it is an extraordinary party trick. It is worth pointing out, as the owner said, it's pattern recognition. So it's looking at shapes that the dog can distinguish, and she was trained by using really positive reinforcement. So every time she would get one, she would get lots and lots and lots and lots of treats. That said, the dog is brilliant. It's one of those, I kept looking down at my dogs when I was interviewing her, thinking, get on with it, guys. And they just are lying around being dogs. And Willow is one of those dogs who she can say, please get me a pen from the other room, and the dog will go and get a pen from the other room. So she's working with something else there that most of us don't know.
Right. Oh, well, tell us about the Deja Foundation.
The Deja Foundation came about because I'm a volunteer at a high kill shelter here, and several other volunteers and I became very, very discouraged at the high rate of euthanasia, and there are wonderful rescues pulling these dogs off the euth list, but they're very overburdened and they don't have a lot of money, and many of the dogs are killed because they have kennel cough, which is very contagious. Most dogs get it within 3 days of arriving, and it's just a bad cold, but it is a reason to kill them, and it's cured with 10 days of antibiotics. So we began Deja Foundation with the intent of, we offer to pay the vet bills and the training costs for rescues, pulling dogs off of the euth list. And what this does is, on one hand, it encourages rescues to continue to pull dogs, because a wonderfully adoptable dog that happens to have pneumonia, they might not have been able to pay the vet bills before, but now we promise them that we will go ahead and pay them, so please pull the dog. And then by providing training costs, you're promoting sustainable adoptions.
What's the website where people can find out more about it?
You can go to DejaFoundation.org, and we are also on Facebook at Deja Foundation.
Rebecca, I've so enjoyed speaking with you. Before we part, any final thoughts?
I would really encourage people to go check out their shelter and do what they can to do for their shelter during Adopt-A-Shelter Month. It's a great time to just go check out what's in your neighborhood and bring a box of biscuits and feel good about it.
Okay. Well, Rebecca, I love the book. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. Bye. And now, let's hear a sampling of Devoted, 38 extraordinary tales of love, loyalty, and life with dogs, narrated by Susan Boyce.
David E. Sharp, a senior airman in the United States Air Force, returned from his deployment to Saudi Arabia in 2002. It was a joyless homecoming. Suffering residual trauma from his deployment, he drank too much, picked fights, and punched holes in the refrigerator door. A friend suggested that he get a dog, so he adopted a brown and white pit bull puppy named Cheyenne. 3 months later, things got really bad, Sharp remembers. I had two military buddies who committed suicide, and I couldn't deal with what was in my head. I went to my room and took out the .45 my father had given me that he had in Ranger school. I was crying and calling myself a loser. And then I pulled the hammer back, put the barrel in my mouth, and my thumb on the trigger. And as soon as I did that, one of the weirdest things happened. This little pup, who was maybe 6 months old at the time, came up and licked my ear, which distracted me, so I took the gun out of my mouth to ask, "What did you do that for?" And then she came over and sat down in my lap and put her head on my right thigh. The pistol was on my left. I understood it was an ultimatum, to choose her or to take my life. I chose her, and I never looked back. In 2009, Sharp founded Companions for Heroes, formerly Pets to Vets, which pairs veterans, active duty military personnel, emergency first responders and their families with rescue dogs. The organization pays the adoption fee and offers free veterinary care for a year, as well as unlimited access to a trainer. Sharp, who now works in counterintelligence, says the pairing of a dog and a veteran is the beginning of returning that person to active society. They choose the dog themselves from the shelter, and if it works out well, and we have a 98% success rate, they have made a good choice. Then they learn how to train their dog, and they are empowered by that. And then they start making other choices. to go back to school, to take advantage of the GI Bill, to get a job. One veteran who has benefited is Lance Corporal Jason Allen, a U.S. Marine Corps sniper who did tours in Africa, South America, and the Middle East. His last tour was in Afghanistan, where he ran over a roadside bomb. Allen survived, but back home in Texas, he was immobilized by pain. He dropped from 150 pounds to 115. He lived his days in despair and suffered flashbacks at night. Desperate, he sat down with a loaded gun, planning to commit suicide. His wife talked him out of his suicide attempt, and Allen spent the next 3 days under observation at the Veterans Hospital. But when he returned home, he was no better. Then, channel surfing one evening, he saw a television segment on companions for heroes. We were talking about getting radial shock therapy at that point, and I said to my wife, let's give this a try instead. With the organization's approval, the couple went to the shelter and adopted Sarge, a Boston Terrier mix. Within days, the dog had changed Alan's life. I had been told by the doctor that I should give up physical activity because they couldn't manage my pain, he says. But when we got Sarge, it's not like you can't play with this dog, and he needs to be walked. So we walk. Sarge has given me a new purpose. He's not a good dog. He's a great dog. When Alan is awakened by a flashback, Sarge pads outside after him. Alan says he now returns to bed in 10 minutes, rather than the 90 it took to quiet himself before Sarge. Sarge's abilities to read his master's moods doesn't surprise Julie Hecht, a canine behavioral researcher in Professor Alexandra Horowitz's Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College. Someone having a flashback will have a physiological change that a dog will definitely pick up on, she says. And what's interesting is that for many dogs, it's a natural response to be calm and close. So it sets a scene in which the dog can slide into its natural state.
We've just heard Devoted by Rebecca Asher Walsh. It was just another day in paradise as Jan and Dave Griffith, along with their blue cattle dog Sophie, motored out for a weekend at sea. But when the sky turned dark and the waves turned fierce, the unthinkable happened. Sophie disappeared overboard. Her heartbroken humans were devastated and could only hope their beloved pet didn't suffer. But this amazing dog did not give up. Her remarkable tale of survival, luck, and persistence is told in Sophie, the incredible true story of the castaway dog. Journalist Emma Pierce recreates the amazing journey of this canine Robinson Crusoe, her swim of 6 miles through shark-infested waters to a remote island where she survived in the wild for 5 months. Annalisa Horton performs the book.
Can I hold the boy? Bridget asked the woman minding the pet store. No, take the girl, Jan interjected. Of all the Griffiths' many dogs, all but one had been female. Jan wasn't keen on taking another dog home, but she knew the odds were already stacked against her. At the very least, they should stick to the gender they were used to. Dave always believed that female dogs had a better nature than male dogs. And besides, he would say, as if it couldn't be more obvious, they don't peel over everything like males do. Bridget picked up the sleepy female puppy, who by this time was shaking. She was a really scared little dog, Bridget remembers. But Bridget held her and stroked her under the chin and calmed her down. The pup was soft and warm, with piles of white-gray fur flecked with blue. She had a slightly upturned nose, like the nose of a little child, and she smelled of dog biscuits and freshly laundered towels. Once calm, the puppy turned her head to Bridget and licked her face. Deal breaker, absolute deal breaker, Bridget says now. Bridget put the puppy back down in the window, and mother and daughter walked outside to discuss what getting a new dog was going to mean for the family. Outside, as Bridget worked up every angle to convince her mum that there was no reason not to get a puppy, the tears started to fall. If it took a mini tantrum, Bridget was prepared to go there. She had been looking at these puppies for weeks, just dying to take one home. She practiced the age-old refrain. She would feed it and look after it, she promised. All the other Griffith children had had their own dog. It was her turn now. Jan wasn't fooled. She knew her theatrical daughter could lay it on thick when she wanted something. Bridget was being over the top, but Jan couldn't help sort of admiring her for it. This girl knew what she wanted and how to get it, and in fact, Jan didn't need a whole lot of convincing. She was already smitten with the tiny pups. Jan agreed to go back into the pet store and let Bridget hold the girl dog once more. Looking on as Bridget nuzzled with soon-to-be Sophie, Jan clasped her hands over her mouth in adoration. The girl and the puppy looked like they belonged together, and clearly they were both falling head over heels. Bridget handed the puppy to her mother, and just like that, another Griffith woman fell hopelessly in love. Jan told the girl in the store that they were coming back for the female puppy and entreated her not to sell her, but they all knew that the clock was ticking. The rest of the litter had already gone, so there had to be more Bridgets out there trying to convince more Jans that now was the time for that new puppy. Jan just needed to clear it with Dave, who was over at the offices of the family electrical business. When Jan called to say they needed to talk seriously, Dave became pretty nervous. Dave Griffith was a broad-shouldered man in his early 60s who wasn't generally the nervous type, but it wasn't often that he got a call from his wife of 30 years announcing that they had to have a serious talk. He suddenly worried. Was she going to leave him or something? He couldn't really believe that there was anything badly amiss, but then again, he had just bought the family's first boat, Honey May. She was a 32-foot third-hand motor cruiser with very tight living quarters, two tiny bedrooms, and a saloon with faux leather upholstery. Not exactly a yacht, but still. He'd bought the boat so that he and Jan could enjoy their later years out on the ocean, fishing, whale-watching, and relishing the marine paradise that their tropical town afforded them. But when he got the call to say that Jan was on her way over, he began to wonder if this latest toy might have been enough to throw Jan into a bout of wifely discipline. Dave was mistaken. Jan pulled up to the office of Dave Griffith Electrical Services and, leaving a highly excited Bridget in the passenger seat, walked into Dave's office, white pants very crisp and a resolute expression on her lips. "We're getting a new dog," she announced. Dave frowned, then raised his eyebrows. Relief flooded through him as he realized that there was no drama after all. "Yeah, yeah, whatever you want," he responded to his own relief, "as long as you're not divorcing me."
That was Sophie by Emma Pierce. In 2002, Larry Levin and his twin sons took their seriously ill cat to an animal hospital near Philadelphia. Sadly, the cat didn't make it. What began as a terrible day got brighter as the ugliest dog they'd ever seen, one missing an ear and with half his face covered in scar tissue, ran up to them and captured their hearts. Thus begins Oogie, the dog only a family could love, a tale endorsed with two paws way up by the book report. Oogie had been used as bait for fighting dogs when he was just a pup. He'd been thrown into a cage and left to die, but was rescued by police who took him to the animal hospital. The Levins, unable to resist his charms, made him part of the family. Joe Barrett narrates.
I think I see Noah stretched out on the futon, opened up on the floor, wrapped in two blankets, which would mean that Dan is on the old couch adjacent to the rear glass wall. Behind Dan on the couch, stretched lengthwise, one paw draped over Dan's shoulders, Oogie is barely distinguishable from the white comforter covering Dan. No one so much as stirs. I toggle the lights back down and click them off. In the kitchen, I put cold water into the coffee maker, measure out coffee into the filter, and press the on button. The amber light comes on, the water roils, and the aroma of brewing coffee begins to waft through the air reassuringly. I turn on the radio to get a weather update that I can pass on to the boys. This radio must be at least 40 years old. It used to sit in the kitchen of the home I grew up in, and I have no idea how I have it still. The reception is poor, scratchy, and thin, as though the voices inside are being played from an old phonograph record. I return to the family room and turn on both the front and rear sets of lights halfway. This time, Oogie lifts his head and looks at me. He is still somewhat distant with sleep, but welcome shines in his eyes like candles. His tail thumps softly against the back of the couch. Smiling, I walk over to him and sit on the arm of the sofa, trace my fingers against the thickness of his neck. I touch the well of power just behind there, high on his back, between his shoulders. His strength never ceases to amaze me. It seems almost incompatible with his gentle nature. "Hello, doggy boy," I murmur. "You're a lucky dog. You're a good doggy. You're a good boy. A good boy. Thank you for protecting the boys last night. I'm glad I don't have to worry about that anymore." I bend over him and touch my nose to a spot just behind his neck. He makes that grunting sound that signifies absolute contentment. When I lift my face from between his shoulders, he raises his head and licks my nose. In return, I nuzzle the side of his face that still has an ear. "I've got to get everything going," I tell him. "You and I will go out later, okay?" He cocks his head, the ear standing up at alert. I cup it with one hand and knead it gently. I have been told that there are many nerve endings in a dog's ears, and that by rubbing them, one can relax the whole dog. Because Oogie has only one ear, the task is simplified, but at the same time it raises some odd questions. Can only half of Oogie get relaxed by rubbing his remaining ear? If so, would that be his right side, the side that still has an ear? Or are dogs left-eared and right-eared the way humans are left and right-brained, so that his right ear controls the left side of his body? Clearly, there are many things about dogs that I have yet to learn. "Don't get excited just yet," I caution him. "There are things that I need to get done before we can party." When I rise, he does too, stretching with a soft grunt. Then he reverses himself and curls up with his head next to Dan's hip. He sighs contentedly before he closes his eyes and drifts off to sleep again. Neither boy has moved. "Yo," I say to them. "Time for breakfast. Who's having what?" There is no response. "Breakfast time," I repeat, a little louder. From the incoherent mumbling that rises briefly in response, I determine that the boys have lived through the night, although it is still impossible to tell whether they may have entered into permanent vegetative states. "Breakfast orders, please," I repeat, louder still. "Don't yell," Noah moans without lifting his head from the pillow or even turning it in my direction. "I'm not yelling," I explain. "This would be yelling." Oogie's head jerks up, trying to understand whether he should be concerned about the change in timbre. I drop my voice back to normal. "I'm just trying to get your attention." Oogie's head goes back on the pillow, reacting to the sound of my voice as though controlled by a string. His ear flops over against the side of his head. I manage to get the boys' breakfast requests, then turn on the TV for them as I head out the door.
That was Oogie by Larry Levin. Temple Grandin's professional training as an animal scientist and her history as a person with autism gives her special perspective. In Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior, Grandin and co-author Katherine Johnson present their theory that autistic people often think the way animals think, making autistic people uniquely qualified to translate animal talk. Exploring animal pain, fear, aggression, love, friendship, communication, learning, and even animal genius, Grandin offers unparalleled observations and ideas about the animal world. Andrea Gallo narrates.
The funny thing about the school was, the horses had emotional problems too. They had emotional problems because in order to save money, the headmaster was buying cheap horses. They'd been marked down because they had gigantic behavior problems. They were pretty, their legs were fine, but emotionally they were a mess. The school had 9 horses altogether, and 2 of them couldn't be ridden at all. Half the horses in that barn had serious psychological problems. But I didn't understand that as a 14-year-old. So there we all were up at boarding school, a bunch of emotionally disturbed teenagers living with a bunch of emotionally disturbed animals. There was one horse, Lady, who was a good horse when you rode her in the ring, but on the trail she would go berserk. She would rear and constantly jump around and prance. You had to hold her back with the bridle, or she'd bolt to the barn. Then there was Beauty. You could ride Beauty, but he had very nasty habits like kicking and biting while you were in the saddle. He would swing his foot up and kick you in the leg or foot, or turn his head around and bite your knee. You had to watch out. Whenever you tried to mount Beauty, he kicked and bit. You had both ends coming at you at the same time. But that was nothing compared to Goldie, who reared and plunged whenever anyone tried to sit on her back. There was no way to ride that horse. It was all you could do just to stay in the saddle. If you did ride her, Goldie would work herself up into an absolute sweat. In 5 minutes, she'd be drenched, dripping wet. It was flop sweat. Pure fear. She was terrified of being ridden. Goldie was a beautiful horse, though, light brown with a golden mane and tail. She was built like an Arab horse, slender and fine, and had perfect ground manners. You could walk her on a lead, you could groom her, you could do anything you liked, and she was perfectly behaved, just so long as you didn't try to ride her. That sounds like an obvious problem for any nervous horse to have, but it can go the other way, too. I've known horses where people say, "Yeah, you can ride them, but that's all you can do with them." That kind of horse is fine with people in the saddle and nasty to people on the ground. All the horses at the school had been abused. The lady they bought Goldie from had used a nasty, sharp bit and jerked on it as hard as she could, so Goldie's tongue was all twisted and deformed. Beauty had been kept locked in a dairy stanchion all day long. I don't know why. These were badly abused animals. They were very, very messed up. But I had no understanding of this as a girl. I was never mean to the horses at the school. Other kids were sometimes. But I wasn't any horse-whispering autistic savant, either. I just loved the horses. I was so wrapped up in them that I spent every spare moment working the barns. I was dedicated to keeping the barn clean, making sure the horses were groomed. One of the high points of my high school career was the day my mom bought me a really nice English bridle and saddle. That was a huge event in my life, because it was mine, but also because the saddles at school were so crummy. We rode on old McClellans, which were honest-to-God cavalry saddles first used in the Civil War.
We've just heard Animals in Translation by Temple Grandin and Katherine Johnson. In Nick Trout's The Patron Saint of Lost Dogs, Dr. Cyrus Mills returns to his hometown after inheriting his father's failing veterinary practice. Cyrus intends to sell the practice and get out of town, but then his first patient, a down-on-her-luck golden retriever, wags her way through the door. With the help of a black Labrador gifted in the art of swallowing underwear, a Persian cat determined to expose her owner's lover as a gold digger, and the allure of a feisty pretty waitress from the local diner, Cyrus gets caught up in the new community and its endearing resonance, both human and animal. Peter Burkrot narrates.
The passage of time may have made this space shrink, but right now it feels austere, more claustrophobic than cozy, a pervasive tang of antiseptic in the air. So Frida was one of Cobb's patients? I ask. No, I don't understand. She's not his patient. This is probably her first time at a vet's office. Probably. What does probably mean? The man blinks slowly as he speaks. He has a receding hairline, leaving plenty of forehead real estate for worry creases. His necktie is slack, top button of his shirt undone, and I can see red chafing around his throat. Probably not used to being constrained by a starched collar. But at that moment, what strikes me most is that, as far as I can tell, not a single strand of blonde golden retriever hair clings to any surface of his dark suit. Is she sick? I ask, looking down at Frida. She has settled, and by settled, I mean she has become an appendage glued to the side of my right leg. It's as if we are conjoined, like contestants bracing for a man-dog six-legged race. And she refuses to be calm unless one of my hands is touching the top of her head. I poke the fur on her head gently. So what if my contact looks more like a wary blessing than a friendly pat? She's having accidents. The man ratchets up the volume and furrows his brow, as though this is more than enough justification to terminate her life. Every morning, exact same spot. I just had the floors redone, and they're already ruined. You know, it's not like I want to do this or nothing. His bluster sails past me. Instinctively, I latch on to the details. Accidents? Urination or defecation? She pees in the kitchen. A lot. What's a lot? A normal adult dog in a normal environment produces anywhere between 20 and 40 milliliters of urine for every kilogram of body weight in a 24-hour period. Assuming she weighs, let's say 90 pounds, or roughly 40 kilos, then a volume of... All I know is she's peeing like a racehorse. I remove the coarse nylon collar from around Frida's neck. She's not going anywhere. Is she spayed? Dunno. He glances down at the cell phone in his hand and begins keying something into the phone. You have no idea, I say. He stops moving his thumbs and looks up with a glare. I decide to change tack. Eating okay? Sure. Any vomiting? He shakes his head. Is she always looking for water, drinking from the toilet bowl? That's disgusting. Now I raise my eyebrows. Not so as I've noticed. I take a step closer to the man and am once again bowled over by the smell of booze. My golden shadow follows suit. Well, I'm sorry to be so blunt, but something isn't adding up. The man rocks back a little in his stance, twists his face into a frown of incredulity. I have stopped petting Frida, and judging by the frenzy of her busy snout in and around my crotch, she's not pleased. She barks and I relent. Let's review the facts, I say, feeling more confident on firmer ground. For starters, your dog is obese. There's no evidence of weight loss, and therefore inappropriate urination secondary to underlying cancer seems unlikely. Absence of bilaterally symmetrical alopecia tends to rule out Cushing's disease, and your history doesn't fit with kidney disease or diabetes. From a purely physiological standpoint, a dog simply cannot have a normal water intake and excessive urination in one specific location and at only one specific time of the day.
That was The Patron Saint of Lost Dogs by Nick Trout. In Bad Dog, a Love Story by Martin Keene, we meet Ola. She's a nightmare who tackles strangers, chews on furniture, runs after buses, and drug dealers. Ola may be the most beautiful Bernese Mountain Dog in the world,
but she's never been trained, at least not by anyone who knew what he was doing. Ola's supposed master, Marty, is a high-functioning alcoholic. A TV writer-turned-management consultant, Marty's in debt and out of shape. He's about to lose his job and is on the verge of losing his wife. Desperately trying to save his marriage, Marty throws himself headlong into the world of competitive dog training. Unfortunately, he knows even less than Ola, who has the distinction of having been expelled from puppy preschool twice. Somehow together, they need to get through the American Kennel Club's rigorous canine good citizen test. It won't be easy, but it will be fun. David Drummond narrates.
She's a beautiful, tricolored, purebred dog, a spectacularly fluffy, optimistic creature with true Broadway spirit and an explosive commitment to now. I keep expecting her to stand up on her hind paws to make her Tony acceptance speech. I remember when I was a little puppy, lying on my doggy bed watching Beethoven's Third on DVD and thinking, I can do that. And I mean no disrespect to her when I say that, all things considered, taking the long view and giving her the full benefit of the doubt, she was a horrible bitch. Storm clouds morph from a hazy gray to an oily, ominous rust as the volume of snow per square inch of air throttles up. Hola, come, I say, holding open the car's back door. Because I have enough cut-up raw liver in my snow jacket pocket to open a meat market, she jumps out. I saddle her into her little harness, lock the car, check that I have her dog license, rabies tag, hairbrush, and, the critical item, her complete attention. Then I tuck myself into classic dog handler's healing position, left arm bent, with my hand on my sacral third chakra, body erect, and as still as the truth. Stepping off on my left foot, cueing Ola to heel, I start toward our destiny. Miraculously, she follows. Step, step, head up, sky down. My jeans feeling loose on my stress-addled torso, I can finally exhale. We skate the iron ramp, negotiate past a boxer puppy in the outer swing doors, and I ask Ola to sit in front of the second set of doors so I can precede her. Always lead, you see. Follow a dog, and you follow a doubt. Ola, sit. Remember, name first, command second. I say, grr. Aversive sound, meaning, seriously, sit. Ola sits. As I pull the door open, seeing the ring set up for the test, with the white PVC accordion gates, the official note-takers and stewards, the distractor dog for the dreaded item number 8, reaction to another dog, a dozen or so of our training buddies nervously clamped to the walls watching the empty ring, the evaluator pacing the expanse of mighty light polymer matting looking for stray treats left over from family manners class, the industrial warehouse roofing and the rusted crates and agility equipment strewn like an A-frame junkyard in the far ring, the beautiful Goldens and Labs and Havanese stress-smiling in a united chorus of, Hello, world! Well, we have only one thought, Ola and me. We are home. Release word, okay. She trails me into the club. What we're doing here is a canine mystery. If you'd told me 1 year earlier that the two of us could trot into Port Chester as legitimate contenders for an American Kennel Club-sanctioned obedience certification, canine good citizen, I'd have thought you had rolled your brain in catnip and set it on fire. Begun in 1989, the CGC is a test of training and temperament. To pass, a dog has to be able to sit quietly for petting and around other dogs, tolerate handling and distractions, walk on a loose lead through a crowd, prove it knows basic commands such as sit, down, stay, and come, and endure a few minutes separation from its owner without obvious distress. Some dogs can pass it after a couple of classes and a pep talk. Then there is Ola. Everybody knew what was wrong with my dog. I could take her anywhere, and she particularly enjoyed the works of Pixar. Obeying my whispered commands was like breathing to her, and at times I entertained the idea she could actually read my mind. Her sits were so straight you could level a cabinet with them, her downstays so still they bordered on a trance. Sometimes I'd put her into a stay, go and have a medical procedure, visit my mother in West Virginia, and she'd still be there when I got back from the airport, patiently awaiting my release. Okay, good girl. Not.
That was Bad Dog by Martin Keene. Readers, I'm sure you'll agree, I was not barking up the wrong tree with this delightful collection of books. For other genres you're sure to enjoy, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today and for putting up with my painful puns. I must try to put a leash on that. So see you next week on The Book Report.